Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
Best-selling author Michael Lewis is with us. His hugely popular books Moneyball and The Big Short can roughly be summed up as stories about really smart guys who recognized how to use data in order to overcome the fallible emotional wreck that is the human mind. Now, Lewis's latest book tells the true story of the two psychologists whose life's work explain why things like Moneyball and The Big Short can happen. It's about Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky and the research that created the foundation for what we now call behavioral economics. Lewis's new book is titled The Undoing Project, A Friendship That Changed Our Minds. Michael Lewis will be speaking about the book at the Harvard Business School tonight, but he joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Magda.
So tell me first, how did you discover the story of the research of Tversky and Kahneman?
I kind of crawfished my way into it because I'd published this book, Moneyball, which was, you know, ostensibly about baseball, but not really. What it was about was the way the market misvalued baseball players, the way people, even professional baseball players, can be misjudged and misvalued to such an extent that a team with no money can find bargains and be a good team. After I told that story, the book was reviewed by two scholars, an economist named Richard Thaler, together with a legal scholar named Cass Sunstein, and they said, Mr. Lewis told kind of a nice story here, but he doesn't seem to understand that, like, the reason that these players are misvalued is that they're being judged, you know, intuitively by these experts, baseball scouts. And the baseball scouts have things going on in their minds that distort their judgments. And these two Israeli psychologists in the 70s and 80s explored the various ways people misjudged when they were dealing with conditions of uncertainty. So that's how I first heard of them. I never heard of Kahneman Tversky. I guess Kahneman at that point, even though he was a psychologist, had won the Nobel Prize in economics. But turned out he lived up the hill from me in Berkeley.
Huh.
And it turned out that Amos Tversky's eldest son, Oren — Amos had died in 1996, but his eldest son had been my student the 1 year I taught at Cal, and be kind of one of my favorite students, and he was a friend. So I started to get to know their story started to spend a lot of time with Danny Kahneman and realized that in this relationship between Amos and Danny, there was an unbelievably moving, sad, poignant love story that generated these ideas. And it was that love story that actually attracted me to it in the first place.
So tell me more about them, because in many ways it's like opposites attract, right? They were very different men. Their approach to, you know, how they viewed even the day-to-day work that they did was very different.
So the short answer to that is, Danny, who was a Holocaust kid, he was I think 7 when Germany invaded France, where he lived with as a Jew with his parents, and they went on the run for the next 4 years. He was living in kind of barns and chicken coops and so on and so forth. He emerges from that as this kind of embodiment of doubt. He doubts himself. He doubts other people. He doubts his own ideas. He's kind of gloomy and pessimistic, a little neurotic, hard to get to know. Incredibly interesting. Like, everything that comes out of his mouth when he's teaching is interesting. Interesting in the way a novelist is interesting. Insightful about human beings.
Mm-hmm.
Amos is born in Israel and raised to be a Spartan warrior. He's a war hero, totally sure of himself, the smartest person anybody's ever met. Dick Nisbet, who is a psychologist at Michigan, designed the shortest intelligence test ever designed. He said, the longer it takes you to figure out, after you've met Amos Tversky, that Amos is smarter than you, the stupider you are. And everybody who knew Amos said that was absolutely true. They'd never met a mind like this. Physicists met him and thought that he was smarter about physics than they were. And Amos was very clear in his mind, not neurotic, able to take ideas like the ones Danny generated and generalize them in all kinds of interesting ways. But it was an optimist and a pessimist.
Yeah.
You know, it was a really neat person, Amos, and a really messy person, Danny. Messy in their minds, messy in their lives.
So what brought them together in terms of doing this research that really was so groundbreaking?
The thing that brings them together is actually kind of trivial. They were the two big dogs on campus at Hebrew University, and Danny invites Amos to talk at his seminar where he's teaching kids how to apply psychology. These guys are in Israel. The academics are just different. They're intertwined with the real world in ways they just aren't elsewhere. These guys were all fighting wars every six years.
Yeah.
And Danny was very focused on like real world applications of psychology. And Amos came into a seminar and described what was going on basically in American social science and how economics and psychology had basically embraced the idea of people as more or less rational. The assumption it was
well, it's a foundational assumption.
It's a foundational assumption
of economic theory.
Not that everybody is irrational or that every person behaves rationally all the time, but that to the extent they're irrational unsystematically, that it's an emotion or a mood and Danny challenges that idea. That's how it starts. Danny says, I think actually people are probably systematically irrational, that people are not like doing statistics in their heads when they face a probabilistic situation. They're telling stories. And the way they tell stories are warped in all kinds of ways. And so they started to explore that. But it wasn't the thing about this relationship. These ideas changed the world. They've affected medicine. They've affected law. They've affected sports. They've affected politics. But as interesting as the ideas were and as interested as they were in each other's ideas, what it really was is how attracted they were to each other. Mm-hmm. They were straight men, and they saw something instantly in each other that just lit them on fire. And I think what it was is that Amos had always wanted to be a poet when he was a little kid, and he didn't have that poetic genius. He didn't have that. His imagination was fine, but it wasn't off the charts. What he had was an incredible. He was a logician.
Yeah.
And Danny had always wanted to be a scientist, but he was born a poet. And Amos was, you know, he was the embodiment of the kind of scientific mind. And I think they kind of finished each other's ideas and finished each other's sentences and they completed each other, I think is what happened. And they loved being together. They basically shut the door they went into an office, shut the door for 10 years, talked to each other until they broke up.
Yeah, I mean, in part of the book, you write about how people could frequently hear laughter outside of the room where
Well, they're thinking they were. About, what is their subject? Their subject is human fallibility. And mainly it's Danny and the strange things they do and think as they move around the world. Everything is drawn from life. They aren't like theoreticians. They theorize about it, but the grist for their mill is war, people on the battlefield, people in politics, people in daily life doing weird things.
Yeah.
Danny doing weird things. The message of their work is that we are fallible. We're hardwired for certain kinds of fallibility, for certain kinds of mistakes. And so it's not shameful. It really isn't shameful that we should just acknowledge our fallibility and adapt to it rather than try to deny it. That's sort of the big takeaway of their body of work.
I mean, I feel like it sounds so sensible when you say it, and as they present it in their research, right? Because they're backing it up with experiments that they've done, but the message hasn't necessarily gotten through. We still talk about economics broadly in the same sort of, you know, rational markets based theory that we always
well,
have.
Except they did spawn the whole field of behavioral economics with a flick of the wrist. It's one of the things they did, and every economics department now has these people who are trying to adapt economic theory to what is known about psychological man, about the man's mind. And the work has infiltrated government. I mean, there's psychologists working in government who never would have worked in government before. It was always just economists. Thaler and Sunstein wrote a book called Nudge that grows out of Danny and Amos's work. And the basic insight is that people, when they're making decisions, they aren't deciding between things. They're deciding between descriptions of things. So the way you frame a decision can change the decision a person makes. So, for example, if you ask federal employees if you tell them they have to opt into their pension plan, they will save, 50% less or more than if you tell them they have to opt out. Governments around the world have already started to incorporate this stuff into the way they interact with their citizens. Businesses have incorporated in how they interact with their employees. Moneyball, the whole Moneyball thing. It's everywhere, right? I write this book about baseball, and you have Moneyball for this and Moneyball for that. And why is that? Because people have figured out that in many places where experts are making intuitive judgments about things, the experts have these their patterns to how they're wrong. And you can do better if you have data and analysis to at least check the experts and their judgment. That all grows out of their work.
It's got to make you wonder what their conversation would have been like had they both been able to witness the presidential election we just came through.
I can imagine it. I think they would have said Donald Trump is a byproduct of people's how uncomfortable people are with uncertainty to start with, how much they long for certainty, for someone who seems certain about things that are inherently uncertain. It's the opposite of what people should want. When they're looking for a financial advisor or a doctor or whatever, you drift into the hands of someone who tells you with total certainty they can do this or they know this. When things are inherently unknowable or uncertain and probabilistic, and you should kind of avoid those people, but we don't always do that. I think they would have said that Trump himself was really, really good instinctively at preying on the weaknesses in the human mind that they identified, the way a vivid story can completely shape the way people think about an entire ethnic group. And if there was a statistic instead, you know, if you tell a story about an illegal immigrant committing a murder, nobody stops and says, well, actually, we can go see if illegal immigrants are statistically more likely to commit crimes. And we probably would find out that they're much less likely.
Yeah, but even when people do stop and say, here's evidence to the contrary, I mean, the question is, do people want to hear that evidence?
Well, that's the other thing. Danny and Amos were very interesting on this subject. Once you start telling a story to make sense of the world, you start looking for the information that confirms the story. Confirmation bias, they called it. The mind starts down a track, it's amazing how invulnerable it is to information that contradicts the story.
You know, the story of these two men is so detailed and their relationship that you tell in the book. Obviously, we're only scratching the surface here, but do you think that, you know, their great discoveries, their insights into the human mind would have happened had they not been working together?
Oh, no chance. Yeah. No, it's totally a story of marriage, of collaboration. Their work outside their collaboration was nothing like the work they did together, and not nearly as good. It was interesting in its own right, but this stuff is world-changing. And they could not disentangle their work. They couldn't figure out who did what. The outside world wanted to figure out who did what, but they couldn't themselves. So it's totally a testament to the power of collaboration. And how when you, especially improvisational collaboration, just like when you fully accept someone else uncritically and you're in a room just talking and the person feels that unconditional acceptance, how something can spin out of nothing.
Well, Michael Lewis's new book is called The Undoing Project, A Friendship That Changed Our Minds. He'll be speaking at the Harvard Business School tonight. We've got information about that at radioboston.org. Michael Lewis, what a pleasure to be in the same room. And to just be talking with you. Thank you so much.
Total pleasure. Thank you.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.